Yeah, and you can get to the lessons from anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that anybody wants to kind of follow along.
I think we've got some people that may be old, not many, but they can listen that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, oh. We'll do that with Thursday's class, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it does.
So we've got this new communications lady, so maybe we'll speed things up.
Yeah, maybe.
Her name is Mary Chunker, and she did the announcement this morning on the screen. Did you go to your church?
No.
She did a nice job.
What's your name?
Junker, J-U-N-K-E-R, Mary is her first name. If they had advertised for that position in the
they just hired her then, huh?
She's just
yeah, good. Replace Olivia? Yeah, Olivia's a tough replacement. She was a good worker.
Okay. I guess that's who they call her, communications?
Yeah, director. Yeah. Olivia Dietrich was the girl that was here.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then she just left. And so apparently they've hired another gal to do that.
Yeah,
man, good. There's another young lady who works in there named Haley, Haley Nance.
Yeah.
She does other things, but I think she fills in the gaps when they need help.
I think she does all the production of the, you know, videos and things
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she maintains the website.
Yeah. She's got a nice camera.
Yeah.
Well, she bought a camera that's
she's probably worth more than I am.
She
was a communications major. I think she went to Stephen F. Austin.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, Haley's a real nice young lady, too. Glad to have her. Oh, is that right? Huh. Well, okay. Well, you see this chart thingy here on the screen? It's kind of a summary of the book of Daniel in some ways, sort of a high-level summary, because the book of Daniel gives us this prophetic history from about 600 B.C., that's supposed to be a 5 there, but at any rate, from there all the way down to, well, actually for sure, down to here, maybe here, I can't remember if we'll have a reference to the, I think it actually goes down, well, it probably even goes down to here, I don't know. Anyway, it shows us all of this history through this series of visions that we're putting together here. We've seen one in chapter 2, which is kind of the basic fundamental framework of all of this. And what it showed us was that there's going to be from 600 B.C., the time of the Babylonian Empire, there's going to be these four Gentile world powers that will dominate the nation Israel. And those are Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And Rome has a particular characteristic about it, different from the previous three, in that nobody ever actually gobbled up the Roman Empire. It kind of just fractured and fell apart a little bit. Pieces went here and pieces went there. But these other ones, somebody gobbled them up. But the Roman Empire kind of goes into sort of a hibernation of sorts as a world empire, and then comes back to life at some point in time. We don't know yet when, from Daniel, we're going to find out here as we go, but it will come back to life during this 7-year period of time, and we'll see that as we go along. We don't know that yet from just chapter 2. And this form of this government comes back to life is a 10-nation federation, okay? It's a conglomerate of some sort. And the characteristic of it, as we saw in chapter 2, was that it wasn't very cohesive. The iron and clay mixed together wasn't very, let's say, homogeneous. It was pretty heterogeneous. It was kind of a loosely knit group of 10 nations. And we're seeing here in chapter 7 that those 10 nations, the leadership of those 10 nations, gets... three of them get ripped up by another king that comes to life during this time here. So that adds a new twist to what we saw in chapter 2. Chapter 10 tells us that of the 10 nation confederation, three of those will be taken over and defeated by an 11th king, an 11th horn. that will also come out of that old Roman Empire. Let's look at chapter 7 again. The vision is of four different animals. Verse 4 is a lion. Verse 5 is a bear. The lion is Babylon. The bear is Medo-Persia. 6 is a leopard. That's Alexander's Greek Empire. And 7 is this, well, it's just called a beast. And it had large iron teeth, and it devoured things, and it was different from the previous ones before it because it's stronger and never is actually defeated by anybody else. And then these horns that are referred to in verse 8 are the leaders, are the kings of that 10-nation federation. And then look how it sort of takes on a different personage. In verse 8, the horns become a person. They start seeing things and uttering things. And ultimately, they're defeated by the Ancient of Days. He comes forth in a scene of judgment and destroys that empire. So whatever else is going on with it, it will ultimately be destroyed by God. Verse 11, I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. Now this 11th horn that rises up and defeats the three in the 10-nation federation here, one of them is an absolute braggart, boastful, godless guy. He kept, and Daniel kept looking until the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Ultimately, this leader will end up in the lake of fire, so he clearly is not a godly man. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Now, what he's, I think, meaning by this, let me see if I brought my little collapsible pointer. That kind of illustrates this thing. If I still have that or not. Oh, I do. Don't ever throw away anything. You see, what's going on here is that those four empires, there's one, there's two, there's three, and there's the fourth one. You see that? One, two, three, four empires, right? Now, the fourth empire will actually contain and embrace, if you do this, the characteristics and elements of the other three. They're inside number four there, right? See that? So the Roman Empire actually will end up embracing and containing characteristics of these previous three. That's the extended life that they have that verse is talking about. They're traits and characteristics of the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, and the Greek Empire will all be included and embraced in number four, the Roman Empire. See, got the picture how that kind of one goes in the other one?
Are we going to see a repeat of this when we get that group that's against Israel?
State that question again now.
We know that there's going to be a federation.
This yes.
It's going to be against Israel. They're going to stand alone. Is this tying back into that in any way?
Yes, yes, yes. This empire here, the one that is still future for us, everything from here back is past.
What we're talking about, this is to come.
Yeah, this is still to come. This dotted line is at the rapture. So this form of the old Roman Empire, the rebirth, the 10-nation federation, will come together after the rapture. Now, we'll see some of the things I'm telling you we haven't seen yet, but we will see them as we go along. So Daniel goes on, verse 13, he says, "And I kept looking in the night vision, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him." This is Revelation chapter 5, where our Savior is given the right to judge mankind. And this is a scene just like this one being just told to us ahead of time. "And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So the Messianic kingdom, which will then transition into eternity, is a kingdom that will come about at the times of this one coming back to life and destroy it. And we're part of that kingdom. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. This vision bugged Daniel pretty good. The visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. So this angel is going to tell Daniel what all of this stuff means, which is good for him and good for us. So now we've got the vision. Here's the interpretation of the vision, starting in verse 17. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth. So the beasts in chapter 7 are the same kingdoms that we saw in chapter 2, these four. And they are headed up by political leaders, just like any kingdom would be. Four in number. And they rise up from Gentile nations, the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Ultimately, all of these Gentile world empires will be destroyed by the returning Messiah. Then I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. Hey, tell me a little bit more about this fourth guy, because he's different than the previous three. He sort of goes into hibernation, comes back to life with a 10-nation conglomerate at the end of it, and I'm a little confused about that. Tell me about that one, Daniel says. Because it differed from the others, exceedingly dreadful. Now, you got to understand the magnitude here, because these previous empires were dreadful. And if this one... if they pale in comparison to this one is something special. Exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, it trampled down the remainder with its feet. This empire will trample men during its time. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and that other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely, the horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. So tell me about this 11th horn that kind of stomps the other three and takes over from them. And so the angel says then in verse 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. This kingdom will have worldwide domination. Now, the others did also relative to the the population of the earth and so on at that time. This one will be the same way in relation to the entire earth and the 8 billion or so people on it. The 10 horns out of this kingdom, this angel goes on to say, 10 kings will arise. Now, they come up out of the old Roman Empire. Remember that? We've talked about this a few times now. Pam, can you reach the light switch? These 10 nations will arise out of some conglomerate out of what you see here inside this red boundary. The red boundary is the old Roman Empire. That's the one that sort of goes into hibernation. And from those countries, some sort of a 10-nation federation will form. Is the U.S. in those boundaries? We're not in those boundaries, are we? How is it that a nation will form out of the old Roman Empire countries and not include us?
We don't have Russia there either.
No, not in that federation.
They don't have China either.
Yeah. No, this is a European old Roman Empire redux. Now, how is it that we, the big boy on the block, becomes irrelevant to the formation of this last world empire.
Well, you can see it right now, the way we're being governed.
Absolutely, right now.
Politically and militarily, it looks like we're decaying rapidly, aren't we not? Are we? Bad leadership is leading us to a bad standing. I wonder if that's enough. Why would these nations form with no relevance to us whatsoever? If we go on much longer the way we're going, that would be one explanation. I can see that happening.
Well, you want us as a teammate with the leadership that we have?
Yeah, yeah. And it can get worse, can't it? We're one heartbeat away from it being worse. Mm-hmm. You know who our backup leadership is? It's worse than our leadership.
That's the best insurance policy you can have.
Yeah. Here's a couple other thoughts to keep in mind. You know what Yellowstone is, don't you? Yellowstone is a super volcano. The cauldron of lava in Yellowstone is about 50 to 75 miles across. That's a humongous volcano. Volcanologists and people that study that sort of thing say that if Yellowstone were to erupt, the kill zone, the zone in which every plant, animal, and person would die, is about a 500-mile radius out from Yellowstone. That's the kill zone where everything dies in the 500-mile radius. Nothing could survive the ash and stuff that would come up out of that volcano. The destruction zone would go from Chicago to the West Coast. Now, that doesn't mean everything in there would die, but it would essentially be rendered probably almost useless ground and so on. So if Yellowstone, a national disaster of Yellowstone erupting, would essentially wipe out most of the life and productivity and food-producing capabilities and industry and all that stuff from Chicago, let's say the Mississippi, to the West Coast. That same system is actually tied into the San Andreas Fault. That fault line, the plates that separate the left and the right of that fault line would be affected by Yellowstone erupting. That could rip off the San Andreas Fault. So if you took the natural disaster of the Yellowstone volcano erupting, coupled with the San Andreas Fault erupting, what kind of a country do we have at that point in time? I mean, it's just a matter of some people trying to survive is all you got there. You ain't got nothing from the West Coast, I mean, from the Mississippi West. The country is essentially, if not totally destroyed, it's hurt so bad that you can't do much with it. The military would probably have to be involved in just trying to help save lives in the country. All the military resources and assets would probably have to go there. So if you take that kind of a phenomenon taking place, and by the way, what if that happened sort of simultaneous with the rapture? How do you explain all the people missing at the rapture if you've just had Yellowstone rip off and the San Andreas fall? No one would care. Nobody's looking for bodies. Everybody's dying and buried in ash. And it's just a unbelievable disaster. So if a national disaster took place coincident with the rapture, no explanation for the rapture would even be sought. This godless news media we have, they wouldn't care. There's just people missing. You just figure they're buried in the ash somewhere or they're down in the San Andreas Fault somewhere. So, you know, there are scenarios that you can imagine that are within the realm of possibility that could account for why the United States is not a player in this final picture, because we are a wrecked and ruined country, either through leadership or national disasters or both. Both things could happen. So that when these countries, and why would these countries even need to form? a kingdom. Consider this scenario. Iran is bound and determined to develop a nuclear bomb, aren't they? Israel cannot accept that, because that means the end of Israel, and they know that. So if Iran gets close to the development of a nuclear weapon, Israel's going to bomb the daylights out of the facility over there, building whatever it is. That could start a war between Iran and Israel, probably fought by Iran's proxies in Israel and Israel, Hezbollah and the Palestinians and all these people. Well, in the past, when those wars have broken out between those two enemies, Israel has been able to take care of himself pretty well. But the missile technology that Israel's enemies now have is much different and much better than it used to be. The North Koreans have been supplying the Iranians with missile technologies that I think is going to make their ability to hurt Israel a lot better than what we've seen in the past. And if that's true, see, right now what they do is the Arabs, they just throw missiles up in the air and they hope they hit something. You know, they don't have any idea where they're going. Just throw them up in the air. But if you get good missile technology with good guidance systems, you start dropping them down the throat of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Israel's main cities, and you're starting to pile up the body bags way, way more than in the past. Now you need a treaty. Because Iran will cut off the oil to Europe immediately. They'll block the strait over there, Hormuz. They'll block that. Europe will not get its oil. They won't get heating oil or anything else to be able to heat their homes in the winter and that sort of thing. Iran will hurt Israel. They'll try to kill Israel and destroy it, and they'll hurt Europe. They'll hurt these countries you see right there by the strangulation of oil. Of course, Russia would be, I think, helpful in doing that as well. So those countries are going to need some kind of a treaty. Get this fighting stopped. Stop these missiles from flying all over Israel and get that oil flowing again. So let's get together and let's form some kind of a treaty to try to solve this Iran-Israel problem. And maybe that's the origin of it. Maybe it's a NATO-like conglomeration to guarantee Israel's security and safety, because Israel's going to sign a treaty with those guys. We'll see that when we get into chapter 11, I believe it is. So this unit could come together, this 10-nation unit, out of necessity almost overnight. It wouldn't take long to form some kind of a conglomeration to try to settle the Iran-Israel war, if there's one going on, and I think there will be. And there will be a treaty between this country, this 10-nation federation, and Israel. We'll see that in Scripture. He'll sign a treaty with the many, it is referred to in Scripture here. So this group would probably have no interest in the United States joining them if we're just crippled and hanging on by a thread ourselves. If these natural disasters do occur, and if our leadership is so bad as it inevitably is going to be, it appears, why would they care about us? Why would they want us? We wouldn't have anything to offer anyway. We would be essentially a destroyed country if these scenarios I'm suggesting actually took place. So they get together and say, let's take care of ourselves. We need that oil flowing back in here, so let's form a treaty. We'll enter into it with Israel. The United States may, I don't know, say, hey, I would agree or something like that. They may have some kind of a say. I don't think it'll be much. But it will basically be between these guys and these guys, so that Texas gold can be flowing right back into Europe where it was desperately needed. Am I making sense here? Any of this possible? It's all possible, isn't it? Very realistic possibility. So, something goes on, And some guy rises to the cream of the crop over there, an 11th horn, 11th leader, an 11th country, and he will kind of take over and be the leader of all of this. So that's the meaning of the 10 horns are 10 leaders. The 11th horn is an 11th leader that takes over. Daniel says 21, I kept looking and that horn was waging war with the saints. That is this 11th horn. He attacks God's people. Godly people will be under the attack of this guy during this time. He was overpowering them. He was being successful. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So ultimately, of course, he's going to circle the drain and go down it, but for a while he's going to be successful. Thus, he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the others, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. For the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He'll speak out against the Most High, that's God, and wear down the saints of the Highest One, God's people, Israel, and other Christians, if you can identify them and find them. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. He'll try to even change like seasonal characteristics and seasonal things and the laws that govern men on the earth in various places. He'll try to change kind of the basic fundamental social structure of the planet. And they'll be given into his hand for a while. That is, God's children, God's people, will be subjected to this guy for a while. How long? For a time, times, and half a time. Oh, well, that's clear as mud, isn't it? Yeah, it's probably a reference to 3.5 years. A time, 1 year, times, 2 more years, and half a time, so 3.5 is what it looks like here. Now, remember, we'll see in Daniel 9, the time period of the tribulation period is 7 years. That's where we get our definition of how long that is. So this guy will, for half of the tribulation period, he will oppose God's people and be successful in opposing them. Okay? So for half of this time period here, he will be the enemy of God's people. Again, I'm telling you things that we will see that we haven't seen yet, but we will before we're done. And at the end of that 3.5 years, that would be the second half of the tribulation period, I think, is referenced here, the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. So this guy, what do we usually call him? Yeah, the Antichrist, don't we? He's 32 different names for him in Scripture, but that's the one we use the most. He will ultimately be destroyed and thrown into the lake of fire. Then, verse 27, then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and the dominion will serve and obey him. Ultimately, it all ends up transitioning into a godly kingdom that God rules over. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming, and me and my face grew pale, and I kept the matter to myself. So Daniel hears all of this, and he says, oh my gosh, I can't quite manage all of this. This is spooky stuff. You get a kingdom that comes on the world scene at some point in time involving 10 nations, 3 of which get stomped on by an 11th king, and that kingdom opposes God. In every way, it comes out of the old European Roman Empire. Apparently, the Western Hemisphere has nothing whatsoever to do with it. So somehow or another, we're going to be reduced to worldwide irrelevancy through various means, I suspect. We talked about what some of them could be. And boy, Daniel sees this and he thinks, man, oh man, I am floored by all of this. I don't know what this means. This is staggering. Well, he ain't done being staggered, is he? He gets another vision in chapter 8. 2, 7, and 8 are all the same visions. It's just that some of them are more detailed than the others. We didn't know about this from 2, so this has been added. Now we're going to get another vision in chapter 8 that will add even more. So let's look at chapter 8. In the third year in the reign of Belshazzar, again, this is in chronological order, but we can date these things if we needed to, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. That is another vision besides the one in chapter 7. And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the city of Susa. This is the capital of Babylon, or a city in Babylon, not the capital, but a city in the Babylonian Empire, or now it's Medo-Persian Empire, which in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision and myself and beside the Ulai Canal. So he tells you where he is and what's going on. I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram had 2 horns, was standing in the front of the canal. Now the 2 horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. And when you see the number 2 in all of this, and part of the 2 is bigger than the other one, it just smacks of Medo-Persia. The vision starts with this kingdom, not the first one we saw, but now we're into the second one. And it's pictured in such a way that this animal has, it's imbalanced. And the Medo-Persian Empire was imbalanced. The Medes were the lesser of the two. The Persians were the greater of the two. And I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast would be able to stand before him. Nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. This empire is running over everybody. And while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth and without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Well, here comes another animal, and this animal is just moving across the terrain of the earth in such a way as to just kind of blow right through it. Nothing seems to be able to stand in its way or slow it down or anything like that. Here's a picture of kind of the Medo-Persian Empire. Let's get it where we can actually read it. Now all of this was the Medo-Persian Empire. But this next goat that he sees is coming from the west. It's coming from over here. What's over here? What's under my hand? Greece. And it has a conspicuous leader. It has a horn that is kind of above and beyond. A male goat coming from the west very swiftly. And it came up to the ram, which had the 2 horns, which had been standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and shattered his 2 horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Now there was really bad blood between the Medo-Persian Empire and Alexander, the Greek Empire. They got crossways with one another, and there was really a lot of hatred between those two empires. Let's see if I got another map here, which... Yeah, okay. Now this one, this map shows the extent of the Greek Empire, and if you notice, it just kind of takes over the Medo-Persian Empire. Same basic area, same stuff. So here comes Alexander out of Greece, and he just takes over the whole Medo-Persian Empire and stretches to about the same extent that it had before him. And nobody can resist him. He's trampling over the Medo-Persian Empire like they weren't even there. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now, what that is an allusion to is Alexander's empire, when it was broken up, when he died, he handed it off to his four generals. They split it up, and these four guys kind of took what he had already conquered and achieved and ruled over it. I had a map at one point in time, I think I may have left it at home, that kind of showed that division, who took what, but it ain't real critical. We can talk about that another time. I can bring it next week if I need to. But the four, the one horn turning into the four, is the division of the Greek Empire from Alexander into his four generals. They were Ptolemy, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Seleucus. That was the name of his four guys. Ptolemy took Egypt and Asia Minor. Who was the last one of his descent, by the way? Who was the last Ptolemite to rule in Egypt? You remember? It's Cleopatra. She was the last one of his line of descent. Cassander, Lysimachus, and Seleucus. Seleucus is interesting because he took Syria, and we're going to see one of his descendants play a prominent role here in a little bit.
Wonder why they didn't have Libya.
Wonder why they didn't have what?
Libya is not included in that.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it was worthless. Maybe he didn't want it. And see, he came all the way over to near India. The Roman Empire really didn't pursue this far east. It kind of stopped back about right in through here. So they may not even been worth conquering. They may have been a vassal. They may have rolled over and committed to serving him no matter what anyway. So that may be, I don't know about the actual answer why one country was included and one wasn't, but they didn't care about that one. So in this vision, this beast's horn is broken into four pieces, and out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. This particular one is kind of involved in this area here. So of one of Alexander's descendants, is what this passage is alluding to, there comes up this one guy. He kind of was a small horn. He wasn't much to begin with. And he's making some moves in that area, and it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It kind of defeated Israel. It trampled down some of the godly men in Israel. This, I think, is probably a reference to the Maccabean Revolution, which we'll see, again, more of as we go on through this thing. Well, let's just get this vision under our belt before we get off track here. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. That's God. This leader, one of Seleucus's descendants, he acted like he was God. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. So he comes into Israel and throws down the regular daily sacrifice in the temple in Israel. And on account of the transgression of the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. So this guy is actually being very successful in opposing God and his people, this descendant of one of Alexander's four generals. We'll see exactly who he is and exactly how he behaved in just a little bit. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" How long will this guy trample over the normal worship in Israel? And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." Now that turns out to be 6.38 years, 2,300 evenings and mornings. So this guy's career lasts for 6.38 years. He will oppose God, trample over Jerusalem, and that sort of thing for 6.38 years. This descendant of one of Alexander's generals. So, what have we seen in this vision? Well, we're getting more detail, aren't we? We're getting things added to what's going on. Same basic thing, but this one focuses in chapter 8 upon Greece and its posterity. There is this goat, little goat, and then he's actually called a number of things. We call him the Antichrist, but he's the same guy. And in this picture, in this vision, we have a real life character, a person who lived and walked on the face of the earth, who behaves in such a way as to foreshadow this guy here, who we call the Antichrist. So what chapter 8 has told us is that there is a person. He is a descendant of one of Alexander's four generals. The general's name was Seleucus. This guy's name will be Antiochus Epiphanes. And we'll see more about him in just a little bit. His behavior in this 6.38 years reference there in this vision, his behavior back then, happened to be 175 years before Christ, is foreshadowing this guy's behavior. So we have a sneak preview historically to foreshadow for us, to show us ahead of time, how the Antichrist will behave himself during the tribulation period. You following this? You don't have to live through the tribulation period to see what this guy is all about. You can go back and look at him historically. There is a parallel to him, a carbon copy of him that has already lived historically, and his behavior is just like the Antichrist's. And we're going to see more about him. We're not through learning about this guy, but we're just picking up this additional layer of information in chapter 8. So, we can put all this, well, I tell you, let's wait till we see the interpretation before we start talking about this. All right, let's see here. Well, let's go ahead and see how far we get. Verse 15, chapter 8. "Came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Euli, and he called out and said, 'Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision.'" So the angel Gabriel now is trying to explain to Daniel what all this stuff means. "So he came near to me where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. And he said to me, 'Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end.'" Daniel, get up off the ground and listen to me. What you just saw is telling you what's going to happen at the end times. "And while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright. And he said, 'Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur in the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end.'" And the end of Jewish eschatology and history is the tribulation period, because when Messiah comes back at the end of that, it all changes. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. That's Alexander. That's how we know all this stuff. So in this vision in chapter 8, it focuses upon Greece and Alexander, his defeat of the Persian Empire, and what comes from him. So chapter 8 is sort of a Greece feature. Chapter 2, basic structure. Chapter 7 adds a little more detail. Chapter 8 is a Greek feature in these visions. And the broken horn and the four kings that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, though not with his power. In other words, Alexander's generals weren't nearly as good as he was, but they come from his empire. Four sub-empires. And in the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise. In other words, when these guys have about ran their course, we're talking about like 175 BC, a king will arise who is insolent and skilled in intrigue. And his power will be mighty, but not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree. His prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and holy people, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many and they are when they are at ease. This leader that he's talking about here is like he's a twofold guy. He is a guy back here who is like a guy out here. It's like if you have two sheets of acetate, you could draw a picture of one guy on the bottom sheet, draw a picture of a guy on the top sheet, put them together, and they look the same. They behave and act the same. So we're getting a twofer here. One character that is historic, that we can learn from. The other is still futuristic, and we won't ever see him. But we can know a lot about him because he is foretold to us by the historic guy. He'll destroy many while they are at ease. The nation, Israel, was at ease during the time of the Maccabean Revolution when Antiochus Epiphanes attacked them. In the future, Israel will be at ease thinking that the guy who they signed the treaty with, again, we haven't seen it, but we will, they think he's their protector when he is their enemy. He will attack them. He'll even oppose the Prince of Princes. That's the Savior. And he will be broken without human agency. And the vision of the evenings and mornings which have been told is true, but keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days, and I got up and carried on my king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. All right. So, 2, 7, and 8, visions in chapters 2, 7, and 8 are the same storyline, the same theme. They just add different information. The theme is that there will be a 10-nation federation come back to life out of the old Roman Empire. It will have 10 nations associated with it, an 11th one will uproot three of them. And this guy that heads all of this up is like, in both behavior and choices, a guy we've seen historically came out of the descendants of the Greek Empire. Got the picture? It's the same theme, just presented with a little more detail and with certain other things featured in one chapter that wasn't in the other. You with me? Now, we haven't been introduced to the guy by name yet, but his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. 175 BC, he's the king of Syria. Syria was one of the Ptolemites. Seleucus. He was a descendant of Seleucus. And we will meet him. We will meet him in excruciating detail in chapter 11. But what we know right now about him is that he behaves like the Antichrist. So if you lived in 175 BC, you could watch this guy on a daily basis and see what the Antichrist is going to do and behave and act like when he comes on the scene later. Got the picture? Same basic characteristics. One of them is in the past, we can learn from him. And one of them is in the future. And we won't be given a big flip about him because we'll be in heaven and enjoying heavenly environs, but he'll be down here destroying the planet at that time. Again, we don't seem to find the United States or even the Western Hemisphere anywhere in any of these final day events, do we? So that means, well, of course, there's nothing in the Western Hemisphere besides us anyway. I mean, you know, forget Canada, there are nothing, and everything south of the Rio Grande is just a bunch of Marxism anyway. So there's nothing here anyway if the United States goes off the world scene. And that can happen in the various ways we talked about, or others perhaps that we haven't even thought about yet.
You know, we're seeing the same thing in South America. We've got a crumbling Argentinian government, and Brazil is probably not too far behind it. And they're the two strong powers. Chile is not significant in as far as economic influence, and Venezuela's gone down. Mm-hmm. So,
and they're all Marxists.
Well, yeah.
Marxism is the utter enemy of Christianity. So keep that in mind. We're talking about the enemies of God's people control the Western Hemisphere. All right, any questions or comments about anything we've seen so far in these visions? These are, you know, to us today, looking back on them with what we know eschatologically, they may not seem to be all that striking. But remember, this stuff is told to Daniel in 600 BC. He doesn't know what we know, and it's floored him. It just the magnitude of what he is being told is just knocking him to the ground. It upsets him emotionally. The book of Daniel is a humongous prophetic storyline. The greatest in all of Scripture. And we ain't done yet. We're going to get more information. Questions or comments about any of this stuff? Yes. The Antichrist is Satan personified. He's his puppet. He's his guy. As will become clearer as we go on. Now, if you want, after we finish Daniel, if you want to review the events of the tribulation period, in Revelation 6 through 19, we can do that rather quickly if we want to show how the detail in the Daniel's 70th week, which we haven't seen yet either, but we will next week, the detail of that period of time. So we're getting the big picture in Daniel. We get the detailed nits in the book of Revelation. Let's go put on the feed bag. What do you say? Mm-hmm. Joe's probably waiting for you to get him up at that cafeteria. Okay, we'll see y'all next week, hopefully, and hopefully nobody else gets sick or is
Thank
gone.
Thank you for these scenarios. There's something to think about.
Those are just ones that have crossed my mind. I'm sure I'm not right about them, but there's various things that can happen in it. That Yellowstone is that's a country killer. That cauldron of lava is so large that if it were to erupt, like I say, they think the kill radius is 500 miles out from Yellowstone.
Well, and the miles out from Yellowstone will pick us up in Dallas.
Beg your pardon?
500 miles will not pick us up in Dallas.
No, that's the kill zone, but the destructive area goes all the way from the Mississippi to the West Coast.
And that will get us.
And that'll get us, I mean, the food basket of the United States is right underneath that volcano.
Right.
So you take away all that growing region and all that stuff, even if you could manage the destruction, you got nothing to grow anymore.
When you go to Yellowstone, you feel like you're on a different planet.
Yeah.
I mean, the feeling that you get out of the
odd happenings there, isn't it?
Me, I thought,
it's
y'all might remember if you can, and they'll let you pay for it, choice, and also
Rose apparently thought she would be back next week, so she's not, she doesn't think she's got anything long term, I guess. We got to get him tracked down. See how he's doing. We'll find him. We'll try to track him down in the.